From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It's Thursday morning, 7:45, and we're going off to see Nam Tien Street, Nam Tien District, where the bombing was extremely heavy the last couple nights, and to see the site where a B-52 was downed.
This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Christmas bombing of Hanoi, while President Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger were orchestrating the heaviest bombing in the history of the world, folk singer Joan Baez was in Hanoi bearing witness.
I'm glad I went, and it certainly tested my courage. I did not want to die. It was something I don't think I've ever really absorbed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Christmas bombing of Hanoi. While President Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger were orchestrating the heaviest bombing of the war, folk singer and anti-war activist Joan Baez was in Hanoi. She was on an 11-day trip to then North Vietnam to distribute mail and Christmas presents to U.S. prisoners of war. Her activism had begun a decade earlier, first in the civil rights movement, later in the anti-war movement. She was and remains one of the world's most renowned musicians. At the March on Washington for Civil Rights in 1963, Joan Baez sang We Shall Overcome in front of an estimated 250,000 people. In 1966, she joined Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for a march in Mississippi to protest the beatings of schoolchildren that occurred under segregation. A year later, Joan was arrested twice for blocking the entrance to the Armed Forces Induction Center in Oakland, California. She would go on to serve a month in jail. And her activism continued well after the Vietnam War ended. In the late 1970s, she founded the Humanitas International Human Rights Committee. In 1993, she performed in Sarajevo in an effort to bring more attention to the suffering there. Musically, Joan Baez is considered one of the most accomplished interpretive folk singers of the last 40 years. She first gained recognition at the 1959 Newport Folk Festival. From 1962 to 1964, Baez was the popular face of folk music, headlining festivals and concert tours and singing at political events. And during this period, she began to champion the work of folk singer Bob Dylan. Over the years, Joan Baez has been nominated for 6 Grammy Awards. In 1963, Joan Baez refused to appear on ABC TV's Hootenanny show. She led a much-publicized artist boycott of the network due to its banning of Pete Seeger as a result of his political activism. Joan protested the U.S. involvement in Vietnam by withholding 60% of her income taxes, the amount determined used for military purposes. The Internal Revenue Service responded by placing a lien against her, and she continued to withhold portions of her taxes for the next 10 years. After performing for President Lyndon Johnson in Washington, she urged him to withdraw U.S. troops from Vietnam. In 1972, Joan Baez traveled to then North Vietnam to distribute mail and Christmas presents to American prisoners of war. Hanoi also received a Christmas present from President Nixon and Secretary of State Kissinger that year, the heaviest bombing in the history of the world. Joan Baez found herself in the midst of that notorious bombing campaign. She remembers 11 days and nights of heavy aerial bombing and widespread death and destruction. Joan Baez joins us in the studio. She came to the Firehouse Studios here in New York just about a week ago, and we sat down for an hour interview. We began by playing the audio documentary that she had put together with others. Part of it is narrated by the priest that went with her, Mike Allen, to Hanoi. First, we took a listen to some of the tape that she had at that time in the midst of the bombing. And then we talked about her life and her activism. We'll go to the tape first.
It's Thursday morning, 7:45, and we're going off to see Nam Tien Street, Nam Tien District, where the bombing was extremely heavy the last couple nights, and to see the site where a B-52 was downed. Oh my. A woman is crying in the background. Oh my son, where are you?
It's walking to the battleground that always makes me cry. I've met so few folks in my time who weren't afraid to die. But dawn bleeds with the people here and morning skies are red as young girls load up bicycles with flowers for the dead. An aging woman picks along the craters and the rubble, a piece of cloth, a bit of shoe, a whole lifetime of trouble. A sobbing chant comes from her throat and splits the morning air. The single son she had last night is buried under her. An old man with unsteady gait and beard of ancient white, bent to the ground with arms outstretched, faltering in his plight. I took his hand to steady him. He stood and did not turn, but smiled and wept and bowed and mumbled softly, "Danke schön." The children on the roadsides of the villages and towns would stand around us laughing as we stood like giant clowns. The mourning bands told who they'd lost by last night's phantom messenger, and they spoke their only words in English: Johnson, Nixon, Kissinger.
No more burning love, kumbaya. No more bombing, Lord, kumbaya. No more bombing, Lord, kumbaya. Oh, Lord, kumbaya. Save the children, Lord, kumbaya. Save the children, Lord, kumbaya. Save the children, Lord, kumbaya.
We gathered in the lobby, celebrating Christmas Eve. The French, the Poles, the Indians, Cubans and Vietnamese. The tiny tree our host had fixed sweetened familiar psalms, but the most sacred of Christian prayers was shattered by the bombs.
Recorder.
The little tape recorder.
Kept falling over in the blast. Yeah. And there you are singing Kumbaya, Joan Baez, 1972, 30 years ago in the Christmas bombing of Hanoi. What were you thinking as you were listening to this?
I don't think I was thinking. I think I was feeling, because I haven't heard that for a long time. And glad I went. And it certainly tested my courage. I did not want to die. It was something I don't think I've ever really absorbed. I don't think I've absorbed.
Did the State Department, did the Pentagon know you were there at the time?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they knew. And we would get nervous about things like the fact that there was a pencil factory across the street, and that maybe would, you know, would pass for a military target. I sat in that shelter and had violence, nonviolence arguments, you know, most of the time. I remember once when, I'm not sure who was, asked me, I think it was a French press, they were really tough, and it was after we saw that district where the woman was singing, "Where are you now, my son?" And he said, "Well, now how do you feel?" Sort of like, doesn't that change your mind about nonviolence? Don't you want to take a gun now and go to the front or whatever? And I said, no, it just makes me more firm in my belief that all of this is getting us nowhere.
Let's talk about where those beliefs came from. You were born in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about your family, your parents, your mother you went to jail with, and your dad.
My parents became Quaker when I was 7 or 8 years old, so I was exposed to a lot of silence. Kids hate it, you know. You go to an hour-long meeting, and you have to stay for 20 minutes, and we spend our time biting the inside of our cheeks, trying not to laugh. You know? However, the silence and meditation stuck with me, so that it's come back now full-fledged and something that I do want to do and understand how important it is. So something came from that when I was young. My father is a physicist, and he would always get up in Quaker meeting and talk about God and science, and always trying to fuse them. I think in his mind he had to, because he saw what science had done, was doing, and what the emphasis was at that point, which is always the military. So I would hear him. He was socially very conscious and inclined. My mother was that by nature. but she was very shy. She didn't go out and, you know, speak or carry on. But she did, well, you'll know the year better than I will, was 68 or 9 when we went to jail for aiding and abetting the draft resistance cause. And my mother and sister Mimi went with me to jail. Mom went twice.
Well, before we get to that, as we go back in time, your father was Mexican-American?
He was born in Mexico. Yeah, came to the States when he was really young, I think 2 or 3 years old.
And you had two sisters?
I had two sisters, yeah.
And did they sing?
Mimi sang. And my older sister, Pauline, sings, but she wouldn't ever let anybody hear her. She's just shy.
So how did you end up picking up a guitar? How did you start singing?
Well, you know what? Pauline tells a story, which I'd forgotten. My father's mentor, who was a physics professor at Stanford, gave us ukuleles, gave one to Pauline and gave one to me. He showed me 3 chords on it. And I don't remember this, but Pauline says we both went up to our respective rooms and I played. And she began to study. She was a perfectionist. She began to try to get, and while she was getting one chord perfectly, I had put all 3 of them together and went roaring downstairs and said, "Hey, you know," and that's how I started. I wanted to sing for everybody. Why wait till you know what you're doing? And she said that was the end of her musical career, because I was just so forthright, shall we say.
We're talking to folk singer Joan Baez here in our Firehouse studio. This is Democracy Now!, and if you'd like to get a video or audio tape copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. We'll be back with Joan Baez in a minute.
I climbed Reunion Hill. I fell asleep on an Indian boulder and dreamed a dream I will not tell. I came home as the sun went down. What I dreamed.
Joan Baez singing Reunion Hill here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Joan Baez joined us in our studio as she talked about meeting Martin Luther King, talking about when she heard him speak in Asilomar, California.
When I was in high school, every year they would have a big meeting, gathering of kids, I think a couple of hundred kids from all over the country, and they were there to discuss the politics of the day, and they would always have a speaker. And the first time I went, I guess I was 15, and our speaker was Dr. Martin Luther King, and he was 25 years old. And I had already fallen in love with the concept of nonviolence through Quaker meeting and through a man named Ira Sandpearl, who became my mentor. So I knew the history of it, and I knew things Gandhi had done. And then here was this man in the process of living the things I'd read about, and I was completely overwhelmed. And that it didn't change my life. It just swerved the course of it towards action.
The next year, you committed your first civil disobedience in your school?
Yes, I did.
Can you explain what it was?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was just so funny, because it was, we were supposed to have an alert, what did they call them? Air raid drill.
Air raid drill.
And that was, we weren't going to jump under our desks or, you know, put our heads against the lockers. We were all supposed to go home. That already seemed a little screwy to me. It would go home and go into your cellars and I guess eat survival biscuits or whatever. But half the school was taking that seriously, and they were going to go home and sit in their cellars. And the other half was going to go and have what they called bomb parties, and they were going to go to swimming. and there's swimming pools. So I thought neither of those made very much sense to me, so I decided to stay in school as a protest. And I did. And they really didn't know what to do with me. They took me down to the principal's office, and I started talking to the secretaries. They were just floored. I mean, I started asking them questions. I did this. I had talked with my father about how long it would take for a missile to get from Moscow to Palo Alto High School. And so I knew the whole thing was a hoax, you know. And I started explaining this to them. And the next day it was written up in the paper. And the day after that, I was labeled all sorts of things. Of course, the main one was a pinko commie, radical, watch out for this girl in school. She's dangerous. And
you then took a tour of southern campuses. And you were singing. Do you remember that time?
Yeah, that was much later. That was when I was... the first time I went into the South, I was 21. And I assumed the audiences would be integrated, which is very naive. And they weren't. In fact, they weren't allowed to be integrated. And I was furious. And so the next year, I went fuming down there with a contract saying the audiences had to be integrated, but there was no blacks knew who I was. And so we had to recruit from NAACP to get some blacks in the audience. And then I got smart, and the next year I went down with 63, and I went down and I sang in black colleges, which brought the white people, who were my fans, onto the campus. And some curious blacks stayed on the campus as well.
I think we have the version of We Shall Overcome that you sang when you were in...
Miles,
Alabama. We're going to take a listen to that right now. We're talking to Joan Baez in our Firehouse studio here at Downtown Community Television. She's come into town to record a new album, lives in California. We Shall Overcome from 1962 in Alabama. And you sang that at the momentous March on Washington, 1963,
yeah,
August.
I did.
What was it like?
Oh, hair-raising, you know. That's something that you know is historic. You know it already. I was so honored and flattered to be there. I was also very, very nervous, as I recall. I've been at these occasions. It's like they're like gifts. To have been able to do that, be a part of it, be aligned with it, be supporting it, looking out at however 350,000 people who were at that point in history where things were changing, things were happening, they were moving. King was, you know, that speech, I guess everybody knows by now, he had it written, and after a short period of time, he dropped all the thing he'd written and he just took off for his most famous speech of his career.
And you had come to know King over these years, and mm-hmm. then he came and visited you in jail when you were protesting Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Do you remember your first moment when you saw him, when you were brought into actually his room? He was sleeping.
I thought you meant in jail. No, when I'm, I had met him before that, but that was quite a moment. And he was, King was always late to everything. He went on what they called CPT, which is Colored People Time, and he was 2 hours late at this church, and nobody wanted to wake him up. He was in the next room, and he's staying in Ms. Waters' house. And where were we?
Grenada, Mississippi.
So Andy Young said, "Joan, you go in and sing to him." And I was just, I just freaked. And I said, I can't do that. He said, "Yeah, you go in and sing to him." So I went in the room, and there was this chocolate drop on the pillow. Everything was white except his head. You know, it was just, and he was out. And I think I sang, "I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I travel this wide world alone. But hopes have I for tomorrow. I'm trying to make heaven my home." My voice was much higher than what I sang then.
And he woke up.
He said, "I do believe I hear the sound of an angel." And he rolled over and went back to sleep. So I think I went on singing.
And he came to visit you at the Santa Rita prison in 1967, when you and your mother were in prison. Can you talk about the context of that time? Why you? There were so many things happening right around that time. You had become very famous. You were on Johnny Carson, on the Smothers Brothers. And it's interesting because we just interviewed. I just talked to Annie DeFranco, and she said no to David Letterman show because they wouldn't let her sing a song about racism called Subdivision, which was about racism in the suburbs. You describe in one of your memoirs Johnny Carson and the producers talking to you, warning you about why people watch Johnny Carson.
Well, the first time I went on Johnny Carson, it was when I had just started refusing the amount of my taxes which went to the military, which came to about 60% of the taxes. So I started refusing to pay that. And it was a big brouhaha, and they put a lien on my house. They would go to concerts and take the money out of the cash register and so on. But when I went on Johnny Carson, see, they were always stuck because I was a commodity, but I always panicked them. And so they said, I didn't see him till later, but the producers, "You know, Joan, you can talk about anything, just don't talk about income tax." And I said, "Why did you say that?" You know, makes it impossible for me now. And I said, "Well, I'll make a deal with you. If you'll tell me why, then I won't talk about my income." They wouldn't tell me why. They did things like, "Well, you know, if you were my neighbor and I asked you to come to dinner and I said, just don't wear the color blue." I said, "You know, I'd come head to toe in blue. This is ridiculous conversation. Is there anybody in this entire outfit who will tell me why I can't talk about income taxes?" So finally actually it was a Latino working there in a fairly high position. And he said, took me in his room and he said, "They don't want you to talk about refusing your income taxes. They're afraid somebody in the audience will see that and get the idea and Johnny Carson will be sued." I said, "Well, thank you. I won't talk about income tax. I have plenty of other things to talk about."
Going back to 67 at Santa Rita when you were in jail with your mother, we have already played this on Democracy Now! With your response. But let's go back to that time when Martin Luther King came to visit you and then stepped outside on that gloomy, rainy day and was met by some of your supporters.
Let me say how happy I am to see each of you here today, and I want to commend you for your willingness to engage in this vigil and stand in the midst of this rather inclement weather to express your support for all of those who have been arrested as a result of their courageous actions resisting the tragic, unfair, and unjust draft system of our nation. I've just had the opportunity of visiting my very dear friend, Joan Baez, her mother, and our dear friend, Ira Sandpearl. And they all send their greetings and their best wishes to you. And I might say they are in good spirits. You know, when you go to jail for a righteous cause, you can accept the inconveniences of jail with a kind of inner sense of calm and an inner sense of peace. And this is the way they are accepting that experience. Amen. They have supported us in a very real way in our struggle for civil rights, our struggle for freedom and human dignity all across the South. And I decided that in a way, or rather as an expression of my appreciation for what they are doing for the peace movement and for what they have done for the civil rights movement, I would take time out of my schedule to come out to see them, to visit them, and let them know that they have our absolute support. And I might say that I see these two struggles as one struggle. There can be peace. There can be no justice without peace, and there can be no peace without justice.
Listening to Dr. Martin Luther King outside your jail. He just visited you and your mom and a number of other people who were detained there. I got a chance to see him, and he said there are two struggles, civil rights and the war, the struggle against the war.
And they're one. And that's when he lost his direct line to the White House. and I'm sure that's why he was killed.
What was it like for you when he came to the jail? Were you surprised?
Oh, yeah, I was surprised. It was wonderful. I mean, there was a like celebration in the whole jail. Everybody, the prisoners were, I think 60% of them were black. And so they were just wild-eyed. And one of them broke all the rules, dashed through some corridors, and just blew into where we were sitting, which is a little cubby. And I don't remember what she said, but she touched him. You know, she touched him, and then she went yelling back, "I touched Dr. King, I touched Dr. King, God damn, I touched Dr. King, they can't do nothing to me." They took away all her privileges, and she was laughing. It was just heaven, you know.
You had been there for years, meeting him years before with the civil rights struggle. In fact, we want to go back and play just an excerpt of one of your songs about 1963, September 15th in Birmingham, Alabama, the day that the bomb exploded in the church.
Come by my side, and I'll sing you a song. I'll sing it so softly, it'll do no one wrong. On Birmingham Sunday, the blood ran like wine, and the choir kept singing of freedom. That cold autumn morning, no eyes saw the sun, and Nettie Mae Collins, her number was one. In an old Baptist church there was no need to run, and the choir kept singing of freedom. The clouds, they were dark, and the autumn wind blew, and Dennis McNair brought the number to two. The falcon of death was a creature they knew, and the choir kept singing of freedom. church it was crowded and no one could see that Cynthia Wellesley's dark number was 3. Her prayers and her feelings would shame you and me. And the choir kept singing of freedom. Young Carol Robertson entered the door, and the number her killers had given was 4. She asked for a blessing, but asked for no more, and the choir kept singing of freedom.
Bloody Sunday.
Yeah.
Birmingham Sunday.
Yeah.
Joan Baez is in our studio as we talk about her life and the history of the civil rights and anti-war movement. You know, when we talked about Martin Luther King visiting you in jail and you said it was for your anti-war actions, I think it's important to point out what those actions are. For example, in October of 67, you were among 119 people arrested for blocking the entrance to the Armed Forces Induction Center in Oakland, California.
Yeah.
And then you did it again.
Yeah. Then we did it again.
How risky was it for you?
Oh, you know, for me, it was kind of a joke. They wouldn't touch me. I tried to disguise myself with scarves on, you know, so if anybody's going to get whacked, I wanted to get whacked with them. And they knew who I was, where I was, and they wouldn't touch me. And, I mean, I did fun things like sing directly to an officer. I remember singing to an officer once, and he was holding his billy club, and his hands were shaking. And they took him out and put somebody else in. We had one day for the nonviolence types like myself, and the other days they could do what they wanted. And we were very cheerful. Everyone was very cheerful.
But they ended up tossing you out of jail early because of the level of activism you inspired in others when you were held behind bars. The same thing happened with the Berrigan's First Plowshares action.
Well, the joke was, I was in jail, I was busy resting. I didn't have any telephone calls. I didn't have to do any mail. I gained 8 pounds. I didn't realize it, but I was trying to go to sleep one night and I was lying on my stomach and something was desperately wrong. I had too much food in myself. I mean, they grew it there. It was good food. And I was not instigating anything. But my friends were. And they instigated a sit-in and a silent sit-in in the dining room, which terrified the lieutenants and the sergeants or whoever they were. And, of course, when they said, we need a spokesperson, we need to know what you're doing. And, of course, they said, Joan, assuming I had planned everything. And I said, I didn't plan it, but I'd be happy to discuss our terms. And our terms were we wanted to talk to one of the lieutenants by a certain time. We could even do it by phone. They said, no, we're going to call the men over. Well, I'm terrified of tear gas. I think King was, too. I thought, oh, God, here we go. This is, you know, the thing I've been dreading. They didn't. These poor guys came over, and they faced, 60 or something, silent women all smiling. And we'd been singing. And I was sitting next to Dorothy Hill, who was a woman who was 72 years old. And she was the first one they came to. They said, okay, we know you can all walk out like ladies and go back to your dorm. And that was the last thing they should have said, you know. So we sat there like stones. And the first one they came to was Dorothy Hill, and she collapsed. I mean, she just went completely limp. And I thought, oh, Christ, you know, I can't walk if she's going to do this. So I went limp. It was a strange experience. I mean, it was sort of I was schlepped, you know, all the way through the barracks, and then they took me to solitary, to a cell.
Mm-hmm.
I had on me 2 hard-boiled eggs, a radio. I had, you know, everything I needed to be in there. They didn't bother to check. So I could hear what the radio was saying outside about our strike inside.
Mm-hmm.
and eat my eggs quietly and enjoy myself.
You met the man you married there, David Harris.
I did, yeah.
He had come to visit first?
Yeah, he came on visiting day, and he was sort of high-profile member of the resistance, draft resistance movement.
Yeah. And was going to refuse to be inducted himself.
Yeah,
and ended up serving.
He ended up serving a 2-something-year sentence. He ended up serving 20 months.
Mm-hmm. You once said, going to jail is something everyone should do once in his life. It's the only way to see America.
It's the only way to see any country. I prefer to do it here, you know. But I think anybody who runs for public office should spend 48 hours in a jail or a prison. It could even be the most minimum security, but to not be able to be the one to turn the lights out, even, is a shock to people, to not have the control. Ideally, they should see what conditions are like in a terrible place, because otherwise you don't know a country until you know its jails and what happens in there.
Your times of resistance, you also form the study of nonviolence in Carmel, California. Mm-hmm. And you have talked about how late at night soldiers from nearby Fort Ord would show up asking how they could escape.
Yeah, how they could get out of
what
they were in. Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes we could talk to them. Sometimes we would send them to draft counseling. You know, get them to draft counseling to see what they really could do, wanted to do, were willing to do. Sometimes at concerts, young men would come up and hand me the draft card, and I would hand it back and tell them to go. You know, to me, I couldn't do that because it's so emotional in the middle of a concert, and but they did show up, and I remember once. Ira was always very direct. We were in an airport, and there were a lot of Fort Ord soldiers in uniform. One of them came over, recognized me, came over and said to Ira and me, tell me how I get out of this thing. He's sort of pointing to his uniform, and Ira says, really very simple. You just unbutton. It wasn't quite that simple.
You met a POW when you were in North Vietnam, didn't you?
I met a lot of them. We went to see them, deliver mail, talk to them. It was also tragic, you know, They didn't understand what they were doing there. They were showing us this huge piece of shrapnel and saying, this came through the room where we stay. He said, I don't understand it. And I almost felt like crying. I said, well, there are these planes flying overhead and they drop these bombs. And this is one of the side effects, you know. But how could they understand?
We're going to break with Bob Dylan's song, With God on Our Side. And by the way, you can get a copy of today's program, video or audio, by calling 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute.
It means nothing, my age, it means less. And the country I come from is called the Midwest. Was brought up there and taught there the law to abide. And that the land that I has God on its side. All the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge.
We're talking to Joan Baez. In your memoir, And a Voice to Sing With, you talk about your relationship with Bob Dylan, how you met in Greenwich Village. Can you talk a little about that?
I think the first time I saw Bob was in Gertie's Folk Singing, Gertie's Folk City. And he was just standing up there, a kid, and the singing things he wrote that I thought were phenomenal. And I think the next time I saw him was in somebody's apartment, and he was singing Hard Rain, which he had just written. It's just hard to believe the words that he wrote. The stuff that came out is poured.
How did it influence you? How did you influence him in your music, in your politics, the routes you chose to go?
I don't know how I influenced him. I think what he gave me was, and I refer to it as a musical arsenal, you know, because he wrote, if I'd been able to write the songs like that, that would have been what I would have written, you know. And they're songs that are everlasting. And at that time, it's interesting, once they came from him and had a hint of something political, it didn't matter what they said. They were a tool. They were anti-war. They were pro-civil rights, whether he liked it or not.
What do you mean, whether he liked it or not?
Well, he wasn't actively political. After, I think at the beginning, he'd been in the South, and he had been political in a sense by being with the people there. But by the time I knew him, he didn't. I mean, for the next 40 years, people, every time I went to a march, they'd say, is Bob going to be here? And he didn't go to marches, you know.
And what did he think of your getting arrested, of your marching with
Martin
Luther
King? I have
no idea.
I think he just didn't want to think about it all, you know.
He just released a double CD set, Bob Dylan's Live 1975, the bootleg series, and on it. 1975. He's got four recordings of the two of you singing, Blowin' in the Wind, Mama, You've Been on My Mind, The Water is Wide, and I Shall Be Released.
Yeah.
You remember that?
I do. It's Rolling Thunder review. It was wonderful. It was nuts. And it was colorful, especially the first one. It was just wildly colorful, and I loved it. I mean, I had a wonderful time. And then I would go out dressed as Bob, and if the audience is large enough, in the back they couldn't tell. They absolutely couldn't tell. I had his hat with the flowers on it, and I sang just like him, saying, how many times must a man walk down? And I just sang like that the whole time. So,
and they all screamed, Bob, I love you.
Well, they didn't know which one was which. I did it once for Mimi's organization, Bread and Roses.
Your sister.
Yeah. And it was the Greek theater, so there were 8,000 people there. And I decided to get in character. So I went into a little room and I drank a bunch of wine till my teeth were all sort of looking dark. And I don't smoke, but I puffed away, you know. And I dotted a little mustachey stuff on myself. It was very good. I had a wig and the hat. And they said, now we have a special guest today. And I went hobbling out there. I even had a harmonica. And I don't know what I sang, some silly thing. And Mimi said that she got calls. And there was one in particular was from a reporter who swore it was Bob. And her husband said, no, it wasn't Bob. And they finally had to call to find out.
Well, folks, it is in fact Joan Baez who is in our studio. We just talked about people who choose to go the political route and people who go a slightly different route. You confronted the establishment head on. Mm-hmm. It was a quarter of a century ago and before. Yeah. You went to jail. You got edited out of mainstream media programs that you were invited onto. What about today? What do you see as the landscape today? We're about to, I will not say it's inevitable, but the Bush administration
really
is seriously threatening to invade Iraq. Do you see the media in the same way you were dealing with it 25 years ago? Do you see that same level of censorship, of keeping out the other side, or is it even more so?
I think at the moment, keeping in mind that I've been somewhat out of the loop, you know, and that was a decision to do that so I could sing and do a lot of inner work that I'd put off till I was half a century old, and which was the right thing to do because I really am basically a very different person now. And but I haven't been head on, and I haven't been, you know, at the head of the parade carrying banners for quite a while. What I see is just, I see it, it's apocalyptic, what's going on. And when I, there's a book written by a man named Derek Jensen. There are a couple of them, actually. One of them is called Language Older Than Words. And when he speaks of the situation we're in as apocalyptic, it's freeing to me. Because trying to hold it together as the world we knew becomes impossible, becomes a strain. So when I heard and felt that, I don't know how you, I mean, we're all, it's over in a sense. So then in that context, what do we do? I mean, they're gonna cut down every tree. They're cutting down every tree. The president doesn't like trees, you know. It's extraordinary. And it's all about power. People who want power do, you know, can do really terrible things. But looking in the New York Times and seeing the redwood felled, my first instinct, I threw the paper across the room because it makes me sick. And then I thought, you know, I can't do that. I have to accept the fact that this is what's happening. It doesn't matter how many people sit in trees. We're going to lose these gorgeous old trees. And that's the least of it. That's the absolute least of it. And so within that context, it's going to take me some time to figure out what does one do? You know, where do you make some sense?
You say you're a different person now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
I mean that I had been seeing therapists my whole life because I was very neurotic and suffered from that. You know, I mean, my life was generally one big panic attack. If it is, you don't know there's anything else out there. And so, but I did know that I hadn't gone really inside and bitten off the big one and looked at it. And so I decided to do that. And that was starting about 12 years ago. And I did it and I faced it and I went through the things I had to go through. And once I'd started, it wasn't nearly as scary, of course, as I thought. So the phobias are over and the panic attacks are very rare. And that's just, those are just symptomatic things, but the freedom inside has become, you know, sort of like the freedom I was fighting for everybody else I didn't have, and I do have now.
You are here in New York recording a new album, if you can call it now. Do you still call them albums and records?
I call them albums. I'm an old lady, what the hell, you know?
And what, is there a theme?
You know, the theme is, and nobody realized this, but we always reflect the times. You know, it's inevitable. And during a time period that I called in the meantime, after the war in Vietnam was over and people sort of just went off into space and didn't know what to do with themselves, and then we went through the Reagan years where everything went backwards for a while, that was in the meantime. And now we're past that and into something else. And it's very threatening. During the time that was in the meantime, people would say, how come nobody's writing songs like Blowing in the Wind? In the kind of atmosphere of nothingness, you can't, there won't be a song like that. It won't be written. There's no reason to write it. And right now, the songs I've sung are not mine, but they're written by people fairly recently. And we realized as the recording went along that many of the songs were that just strangely apocalyptic. There's a song by Natalie Merchant, which is, where in hell can you go? Far from the things that you know. Far from the sprawl of concrete that keeps crawling its way, about 1,000 miles a day. Oh, my five and dime queen, tell me, what have you seen? The lust and the avarice, cavernous greed, is that what you see? Motherland, cradle me. Close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. keep me safe, lie with me, stay beside me, don't go, don't go, don't you go. Just sort of melancholy, and some of them are much stronger words than that. But.
Do you see yourself now, as you have taken that journey inward over the last decade, and now you're coming out with a new album, do you see yourself getting more politically, overtly politically involved?
Probably.
I mean, you were involved in the nuclear freeze movement. You sang for gay rights. You sang at the bottom of the tree of Julia Butterfly, serenaded her.
I at the top of the tree.
Oh, you were climbing.
Yeah, Bonnie and I went up.
Bonnie Raitt.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I mean, it's in my blood. And just, as I said, seeing the world in this context, of it's kind of all over. You know, there's this line from a Leonard Cohen song, take the only tree that's left and stuff it up the hole in your culture. It keeps coming to my mind. I've always loved him because he's more cynical than I am. And I love his songs. But I don't know what it'll be. No.
Well, we're going to end today with Brothers in Arms.
Oh, nice.
And I want to thank you very much for
thank you,
spending
Amy.
This hour
it's
in our studio.
It's been a treat for me.
These mist-covered mountains are a home now for me. But my home is the lowlands, and it always will be.
Singer Joan Baez singing Brothers in Arms, and that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get The Hour with Joan Baez on videotape or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, and Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica's Democracy Now!